Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the editors of Strategy Page talk about world events, military affairs, and even history. I'm your host, Dan Masterson. With me today are Strategy Page editor, Jim Dunnigan, and associate editor, Al Nelfi, both well-known military authors.
Good morning, Al and Jim. It's good to have you here. We are just finishing recognizing the 150th anniversary of Gettysburg. Gettysburg is a battle that I think most Americans would recognize, even with our poor school system sometimes here in the United States. Al, you and I had a discussion that often Gettysburg is referred to as the turning point in the war, but you were mentioning to me that we should probably look at it as the turning month, as there were other activities going on right around Gettysburg and at the same time as Gettysburg that were very influential.
Yes, in that same month, to start way out west, you've got two battles in Union territory that effectively clear the Oklahoma, in other words, effectively clear the Confederates out of Oklahoma. Then you've got Tullahoma, you've got Grant moving against Vicksburg. This is all going on like from the beginning of June, late May, to the end of August and end of July. You got Grant moving against Vicksburg, and he's been trying to get to Vicksburg several times, and he finally gets the formula down, lays the city under siege, and Rosecrans is up there in the middle of the country. And he's maneuvering against Braxton Bragg, and he manages to advance a couple hundred miles by July 3rd to throw the Confederates, way back out of Tennessee, and he gets a good lodgment in approaching, what will eventually be the disaster at Chickamauga, but that's not going to happen for another couple of weeks. Port Hudson falls, Vicksburg falls, the line of the Mississippi is clear. A lot of commerce resumes down the Mississippi, not as much as pre-war, but still it's a big help. The Helena, Arkansas, is captured by the Union, and so on. And there's this whole series of victories. There's a couple of Confederate successes. Attempt to capture Fort Wagner. Is a fail, in Glory, the movie Glory, fails. The fort is never captured. There's an attempt to storm Fort Sumter and sort of a naval assault on Fort Sumter. That fails. But nothing to compare to this whole litany of victory after victory. The key about Gettysburg, of course, is that it's actually north of Washington. The Army of the Potomac is between Lee and Richmond, and a big victory there. The press can get there very easily. The trains, it's a couple of hour train ride from Washington or Philadelphia. So it's very heavily reported battle. Lee is up there. This is his second attempt at an offensive operation, which goes badly. Because of Lee's command style. Lee is essentially a defensive commander. He's excellent at the offensive defense, counterpuncher. And the two times that he attempts offensive operations don't work out too well because in a defensive situation, he can sort of, tell his subordinates, like, we got to do this. We got to march around the flank and do this. And since the situation is desperate, since they're on the defensive, they're going to act in a more effective manner. At Gettysburg, his style of command, sort of issuing general instructions, is going to handicap him because he gives everybody wiggle room. Starting with Jeb Stuart. Jeb Stuart had a bad moment about a month earlier when the cavalry of the Army of the Potomac surprised him in a very embarrassing situation. He was having a review of his cavalry at Brandy Station. So there were, you know, dignitaries present, there were ladies present, and so on. And suddenly the Union cavalry shows up, and there's this huge battle. And so it's very embarrassing for him. So when Lee is telling him to find out where the Union army is, and you know, he also says, and keep in touch, he just wanders off. He takes most of his troops and wanders off. He actually ends up near, what the heck is that little village? Just Rockville, Maryland, which is like walking distance to Washington, where he captures the Union supply train. But for 3 days, Lee hasn't got a clue as to where his cavalry is, and those are the 3 days prior to the battle. Lee shows up on the evening of the second day of the actual battle. So that's a disaster. He tells Ewell, attack the northern end of the Union line, if practical. Well, you know, I mean, if you're a general and someone says, if practical, you may be a little careless in carrying out commands. There's a lot of reasons, attempts to explain the disaster that basically unfolds on the field, because he does great on the first day. Second day is pretty good, but more or less a draw. And then he decides he's going to have this massive assault, and everybody's trying to explain away the defeat. General Longstreet's telling him, you know, this is not a good idea. So the Confederate sympathizers, of course, all blame Longstreet for his reluctance and even fabricate evidence. But it was an extraordinarily foolhardy attack, badly reconnoitered. There was no scouting parties set out to preliminary to the attack to do things like tear down the fences. No skirmishers out to tear down the fences. If you stand on, you know, when most people go to Gettysburg, they stand on top of the ridge there and look down. And it don't look like much. But if you come from the other side, it's an impressive height. You're going uphill this time, though, and there's these ups and downs and whatnot that you don't necessarily see from top of the ridge. So these guys had fences to contend with, and they had to climb over the fences, which was great for getting shot at. And actually about half his guys just decided not to bother and went back. Because if you figure that 12,000 guys made the attack, not that many of them, you know, they all didn't make it, and they all weren't killed. So a lot of guys just went back. So it's a very sad moment. And the next day, people forget the battle actually is like 4 days. The next day, the 4th, Lee pulls back into defensive formation in the hope that Meade is going to attack him. Well, Meade's only been in command about a week. In fact, he was put in command as the army was already on the march to try and find Lee. And he's had this, you know, 3 days of horrendous battles. Individually, each day's fight is essentially among the top 10 battles of the war. I mean, you have to think about it that way. And of course, when you take the whole battle, it's the biggest battle in the war and the biggest battle that ever occurred in the Western Hemisphere. So Meade, of course, having seen what happened to Lee's grand assault, is not terribly inclined to conduct his own. And he's in a little bit of shock. And his best officers are all down. I mean, even Dan Sickles, who was not necessarily the most able officer in the war, but if you needed somebody to, you know, stand in front of the troops and say, charge, he was good for that. You know? And he was wounded. Winfield Scott Hancock was wounded. John Reynolds was dead. Several other...
Which was a major blow.
Yeah, yeah. Without John Reynolds, the first day would have probably been worse, which probably wouldn't have made much of a difference in the long run, since Meade had already staked out a defensive line a couple of miles further east that arguably is better than Gettysburg. But it was Reynolds who decided to have it out at Gettysburg. He spotted the advantages of the field very effectively. And the Army did well. I mean, there's a whole bunch of sort of, half-forgotten heroes. John Buford on the first day, Strong Vincent, and General Warren. I mean, Strong Vincent is a 20-something-year-old brigadier general. What a name, right? What a good name for a general, I guess, Strong Vincent. He's killed the rushing troops up to Little Round Top. And, Joshua Chamberlain, of course, gets all the credit, but there were other guys holding that hill, too. And, Chamberlain wasn't the only one, but he got a good press.
Right.
And he had a great mustache. I mean, you can't beat the mustache. So everybody did their job well in the Union side. The Confederate side, not necessarily as well, for a variety of reasons. I think I forget what historians said. The battle of the command relationships in the Army of the Potomac were more like a nest of thieves than a band of brothers or something, And it also applies to the Army of Northern Virginia. There was a lot of internal politicking and resentment. Very interesting. Despite the fact, for example, that I think North Carolina had the most troops in the battle, Virginians held most of the command slots, and the Virginian contingent in the Army wasn't that big. But, Lee was partial to Virginia and, so wanted his guys to do better. So it's this moment when, for a lot of reasons, the Army of the Potomac is doing really well, and the Army of Northern Virginia is not, partly because probably overconfidence on Lee's part, his generally careless command style, very poor staff. His staff was a disaster, actually. His staff consisted of mostly friends or acquaintances, many of whom had absolutely no military experience whatsoever. The chief of the artillery, Pendleton, Lee actually said he didn't know what the guy was good for, but he was a nice guy. He was Lee's pastor. He was a West Point graduate, and he had become an Episcopalian minister. But he was Lee's pastor, so he made him chief of artillery. And his only effect on the battle was negative. The actual marshaling of the Grand Battery on the third day was in the hands of one of Lee's other officers, Porter. E.P. Alexander. General Pendleton, Alexander had actually set aside a couple of batteries of field howitzers to accompany the infantry, so that as the infantry got really close to Cemetery Ridge, they would howitzers would start firing shells over their heads and into the ridge. And Pendleton came upon them, waiting patiently behind the infantry just before the attack, and ordered them to the rear. So that was the end of that, So that was a problem.
Well, then the artillery completely misses their target and overshoots the ridge.
Yeah. And most of the shell falls east of the ridge, kills a lot of horses, and blows up a couple of ammunition wagons, which probably looked like really impressive. Of course, there's so many issues. Like Lee had two, Wentworth guns from England that were extraordinary pieces of artillery. I mean, they could fire, with some accuracy 2 miles. There were rifle guns, imported at an enormous expense. The only trouble is you couldn't spot shell. So you didn't know where they were shooting at, I mean, it was fine if you had an open plane and you were shooting at targets, you could see. But, these are nice rolling hills and forests and stuff, so you're sort of shooting blindly. And and all this shell goes way into the rear. I think Meade's horse, or some general's horse, got killed. In fact, General Doubleday was widely praised during the bombardment because in order to steady the troops, he walked down the front, halfway down the front edge of Cemetery Ridge, sat down, unwrapped a sandwich, and started eating his lunch. You know, and a shell came by, and it turns out about the only shell that hit on his side of the ridge, and sprinkled a little dust on him, you know. And that was it. But everybody was saying, oh, man, look how brave he is. Well, actually, he was in the safest spot compared to you know, guys waiting behind the line. So there was that. Just a lot of confusion and a very bad decision.
Right.
Very bad decision on Lee's part. If you think about it, his best tactic, perhaps even better than Longstreet's recommendation that he move around the Union flank, his best option might have been to just occupy a good defensive position where he was. He'd won the first day's battle. He's in Pennsylvania. It's not his job to drive the Army of the Potomac out of Pennsylvania. It's the Army of the Potomac's job to drive him out of Pennsylvania. The longer he stays in Pennsylvania, the more embarrassing it is to the Union. And if they can attempt an offensive against him and fail, he's got his victory on northern soil, which may have influenced the politics of the war. He didn't want that. He wanted to end the war quickly. Now, yeah. You can get some psychological stuff. He'd had a series of heart attacks, which were not revealed until after the war. In fact, I think until after he was dead. Was not himself. He was under enormous emotional strain. Twice during the battle, he let his proverbial self-control go. It's very rare that there are documented instances of Lee losing it. When he said goodbye to his officers after Appomattox, he lost it. I mean, he was hugging and crying with Longstreet, you know, and that sort of stuff. But at Gettysburg, he loses it twice. When Stuart shows up, it's late at night on the 2nd. And although there are no observers to what was heard, what they've said, there was actually. It's depicted moderately well in the film. But Lee almost hit him. I mean, he was so tense. And then that scene as the troops are falling back after the attack on the 3rd, when he rides among them and he's saying, "It's all my fault. It's all my fault," you know. This is, you know, of three well-documented instances of him losing it in the war, two of them happen at Gettysburg.
Right.
So,
now,
yeah.
Jim, prior to Gettysburg, the South was in a pickle because they had Vicksburg going on. They had, like Al mentioned, the stuff going on in Tennessee. Vicksburg looked, well, at least Lee convinces Davis that Vicksburg, there's nothing that they can do to affect the outcome of it. In fact, there's a lot of talk. Longstreet wants to go into Tennessee. They want to strip troops from Lee to send them to Vicksburg to help out. So there's a lot of politics that happen in that month prior to Gettysburg, or the 2 months prior to Gettysburg, correct?
Yeah, there's not only a lot of politics, there's a lot of media activity. This is the first major war in the United States where the mass media played an enormous role. The mass media was only invented about 20 years earlier when the steam press arrived on the scene and made very inexpensive newspapers possible. And entrepreneurs quickly discovered that if they could sell enough newspapers, they could sell advertising, and bingo, you had the cheap newspaper, which in addition to selling advertising, got a lot of news into the hands of people very quickly, because about the same time the steam press came along, the telegraph was invented. So you had these two revolutionary, you know, innovations coming on the scene at the same time, and then along, of course, the railroads and a whole bunch of other stuff. Then the Civil War comes along, and suddenly there's this war, the first major war, where the media could go out and basically apply their news model, which is based upon speed and sensationalism. Now, this is important for General Meade, because he had no patience for the media. He knew what they were doing. He was a very intelligent guy. And he was not a people person. You know, Grant respected Meade a lot, because Meade was in combat, you know, a very capable leader. I mean, he basically did what had to be done, even if in after the facts, there's that way, you could have done this, you could have done that. He did what worked. He quickly developed a very hostile relationship with the media. And you can ask, you know, General MacArthur, even though he's gone, that this does not pay off in the long run. You don't argue with somebody who buys ink by the barrel. And it's this period where that phrase, you know, came to be, and it still applies. Which is why there's a lot of people, you know, in politics who aren't crying too much at all at the mighty, you know, mass newspapers are hurting these days. Be that as it may, the news was concentrated in the East. In other words, newspapers in New York, and especially in, you know, Philadelphia and Washington. And in Washington, most of your politicians, this is something that's continued to the present, got most of their information not from the government, which they had access to. You know, they could basically walk into the Secretary of War's office and ask him, you know, questions. They read it in the newspapers. And the thing that the newspapers were pushing in 1863 was that Lee was invincible. Now, as Al pointed out, Lee may have been doing very well, but the rest of the Confederate military was not. They were falling apart in the West. But the West, was even before the invention of airplanes, it was flyover territory. As far as the Easterners were concerned, it was the backwoods. And they had some very colorful terms for it, but it amounted to the same thing. If it doesn't happen in the suburbs of Philadelphia or whatever, it doesn't really count. So Meade's victory and what he did at Gettysburg was really more important in a political sense, not a military sense. I mean, Al is quite right. The victories won by Grant and the other generals in the West were much more decisive to the fate of the Confederacy than what was going to happen in Gettysburg. But Lee was under pressure. He knew what his reputation was. The Confederates quickly discovered that their best source of information about the Union Army was the Union newspapers. So they had a network not of spies, but of smugglers, who would quickly get the latest editions of all the newspapers, which were known to be the best sources of good leaks, and spirit them, you know, race them through the lines and, to General Lee's staff, where they would quickly digest it all and give their boss excellent, you know, operational, not tactical, but, you know, very good intelligence. What he was getting was that he was, you know, a superhero militarily, and that he could do no wrong. Now, Lee did not believe this nonsense, but he knew that it was a weapon. As Napoleon had pointed out, everybody in this period was still furiously studying Napoleon, although we all know what happened to Napoleon. But despite that, they recognized his battlefield genius. He might have been, like Hitler, a bad commander, but, you know, strategically. But Napoleon won a lot of great victories, and they studied him. And, of course, Napoleon was the one who observed, you know, the Morales to the material as 3:1. In other words, it doesn't really make that much difference how many troops you have. It's how you inspire them to do things they thought they couldn't do. Well, the same applies with politicians, and they found out that they could inspire a lot more people to vote for them via the media than they could in the past by simply going around and stopping, you know, and giving speeches to a few hundred people here and a few hundred people there. So the newspapers and the Telegraph had changed everything. So when Lee and Meade come together in Gettysburg, the pressure is on Lee, and Meade knows it. He may not have been friendly to the media, but the reason he was because he knew exactly how the media operated. And now he saw that, you know, the shoe was on the other foot this time. That was always been one of the great, you know, what ifs in military history. What if Lee had just stood there and said, okay, as Al pointed out, but, you know, it's not my job to get you out of Pennsylvania. I'm the alien invader. You got to get me out of Pennsylvania. And Meade, much to his relief, found that the Confederates were on the offensive, which, as Al points out, you know, is not the thing that American generals at that period were really very good at. We had very few, you know, a few hundred, you know, professional officers, you know, West Point graduates. The vast majority of the officers in both armies were basically civilians, very capable civilians in many cases. But, you know, the way historians and the media sometimes play it, the fact that all these great heroic people in the Civil War was a lawyer, a businessman, a farmer, et cetera, et cetera. This was the norm, not the exception. Defending is much easier if you have smart, you know, amateurs than the offense. For the offense, you really need very smart and talented professional military people. And Lee didn't have it. I mean, as I pointed out, his subordinates, you know, were more often than not, you know, getting in the way of his plans than carrying them out. And, of course, these general instructions don't work as well in the offense as they do in the defense. Meade, on the other hand, again, there are many things Meade doesn't get credit for. It's only recently, as people have dug deeper, you know, gotten beyond the media hostility, which has clouded Meade's reputation for generations, for over a century, how they realized, you know, that he was in an extremely difficult situation. He was only recently, you know, given command of this army, put together in haste. He was basically doing things that this army was not designed to do. For example, march fast. They were trying to keep up. They were, you know, they knew where they were best situated to intercept the Confederates. And he had to march very fast, which the Union troops were not as good as the Southern troops were, especially in June and July. And they had a good portion of their army were stragglers. You know, they had blisters, you know, a lot of troops fell out. They eventually caught up, and they were straggling in, you know, during the battle. So, in effect, he had a constant source of replacements. You know, they might have been hobbling, they might have been limping, but they could still fire their rifles. And again, defend. But at the same time, Meade was a great improviser, and he improvised brilliantly. And, of course, he was saved time and again, as Al points out, by subordinates who were surprisingly talented. I mean, again, when you read the histories, they say, well, you know, this man was either before the war or after the war, successful this, successful that. These were successful men who knew how to deal with, you know, uncertain and chaotic situations. And many of them, you know, rose to the occasion, and it worked more effectively because they were on the defense. The Confederates had a much more difficult time because, again, it's much more difficult to run an offensive, you know, battle like this. And when you think about it, almost all of Lee's victories were defensive victories. And now the shoe was on the other foot, and he got to basically, you know, taste what it was like to be fighting Lee. Because Meade, while not as brilliant as Lee, was in many ways as talented, if not more talented than Lee. And Meade never gets credit for this. He was basically right. Dealing with huge chaotic situation. 160,000 men milling around on this battlefield, and the communication, there was no radio, there were signal flags if people weren't firing off their artillery and weapons and creating these clouds of black you know, smoke from the black powder weapons. But he basically, you know, made the right decisions. He made a lot more correct decisions than Lee did. And because of that, again, after the battle, he gets criticized for not following up. But the basic problem was he couldn't follow up. You know, retreating is a lot easier than pursuit. You know, basically the Confederates were just told, get out, get back south, you know, we've been whooped. And they could just take off. To organize a pursuit, you basically have to be, you know, get yourself in motion to overtake the enemy, and then to basically fight an offensive battle, because they're going to be, you know, they're going to be basically sitting down there and shooting at you the minute you come within range of their weapons. So pursuit, to be successful, has to be handled, you know, with a lot of coordination and with very skilled troops. And it was very difficult to carry out in the Civil War, because this was the first war where you had the mini musket, the rifled musket, which basically gave your retreating troops a much longer range weapon than in the past. And so the cavalry couldn't just make a fast, you know, spurt, you know, at the retreating infantry and cut them down. No, the cavalry, the minute, you know, the infantry spotted them coming, would turn around and they would basically go shooting horses, which is, you know, the way you basically stop cavalry. So, you know, Lee had very little chance, practically zero chance, for carrying out a, you know, pursuit, because he was in a chaotic situation. He had barely won this victory, and he knew it. He was a very practical guy. So what we get out of this battle is the fact that, A, the media tends to establish a storyline, a plot line, as it were, that is very difficult to you know, pry historians, later historians away from. A lot of historians that would go in there and say, well, this is the accepted wisdom. Let me see if I can footnote it more thoroughly. Which is not the same as basically saying, well, what actually was going on here? And more historians have basically started looking at it that way, and they found out that the traditional, for more than a century, narrative of what went on at the Battle of Gettysburg is not quite true. In many respects, it's very misleading. So finally, at the 150th anniversary, the smoke, finally, is clearing.
Right. And a lot of people, one of Meade's problems, too, was he becomes overshadowed by Grant when Grant moves to the to the east.
Yes, but the one thing that people forget was that Meade offered to resign as soon as Grant showed up. He was a fairly humble guy. He was, well, realistic. You know, he had a temper. He basically, when he was in the middle of something, he wouldn't basically be shy about giving orders and what have you. But he recognized that Grant was a superior commander, and he basically offered his resignation. And Grant refused it. And Grant later said, you know, that impressed him more than Meade's victory at Gettysburg. Because
right.
Grant had gotten information through Army channels about what went on at Gettysburg. Grant also had a, you know, a gimlet eye, you know, view of the media accounts of whatever's going on. And he appreciated that was a excellent piece of leadership.
Yes.
But he found that Meade's, you know, willingness to resign showed this guy was even better than he thought. So although Meade had some problems while serving under Grant, he had a lot more successes. Again, the media
right.
tends to jump on any little mistake you make. But as far as Grant was concerned, Meade was one of the best of the Eastern generals that he had to choose from, because Grant basically brought a lot of his Western generals with him.
Right.
And he basically stuck with Meade, you know, through the end of the war.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of people forget that completely. Now, one of the things that's interesting, Al, is both armies prior to Gettysburg go through reorganizations. How did those reorganizations affect the battle, especially on Lee's side with the loss of Stonewall Jackson and what he does with his corps system afterwards?
Yeah, there's a undercurrent, you know, when people talk about what if, they always, for the Civil War, the big what if Jackson had still been alive at Gettysburg? And actually, of course, my response to that is, Well, you have your choice. You have Jackson at the Valley or you have Jackson at Chickamauga. Jackson at the Chickahominy. Jackson's performance could be erratic. And a lot depended on situation, the situation as it existed. Jackson in the Valley, well, he was up against a bunch of not very good commanders in a place that he had been living. He'd been living in the Valley for something like a decade or more than that. He knew the geography amazingly. You know, one of the reasons for his rapid marches and so on was just that he knew the routes when the Union guys, didn't. At the Chickahominy, he's tired, he's slow. He's out of his element because he's no longer in command. Now, he does well under a Grant, but sometimes he's given credit for victories that are not his. At Second Bull Run, for example, we hear a great deal about, how good he was and forget that the decisive blow of the battle was struck by Longstreet. And Jackson's role was to conduct a fighting withdrawal. He was the bait that lures Polk into, an ill-considered advance, thinking he's got the Rebs on the run. And meanwhile, it's setting him up to get smashed in the flank by Longstreet in what was possibly the most devastating single attack of the war. So that's a hard one. How do you, what if it's a what if that,
What about the fact that they moved from a two-core system to a three-core system?
Yeah, that's the more important.
They end up bringing in two brand new core commanders.
Yeah, that was a change that probably should have occurred much sooner. You can even the army was becoming too big for two generals to command. Subordinates to command. You're still basically commanding within eyesight. If you can see it, you can command it. If you can't see it, well, tough luck, And they had reached a point where the armies were just too big for that. Lee seems to have postponed that decision because he didn't know who to put in command of what would become a third corps. Although arguably what he should have done was gotten Stuart to command a third corps. Stuart turned out to do fairly well when he was in acting command of Jackson's troops after Jackson got wounded at Chancellorsville. And perhaps Stuart should have been given the shot, at commanding a corps before Chancellorsville. You reorganize the army and see how this young fellow does. So what you end up with is Lee has to reorganize the army, and he has only one corps commander now. Whereas before he would have had two and three corps if he'd done the reorganization before Chancellorsville. Now he has three corps and only one corps commander, which is Meade. So he's got to pick and choose. And, it's hard to tell. His choices, arguably the guys are qualified. But Ewell, he was getting a little mentally unstable. He'd lost a leg. He was chasing a 16-year-old girl whom he eventually would marry. I think she was 16, whom he eventually would marry. Was he actually up to campaigning since he so recently wounded and his mind on other things? It's hard to say what Hill was about because he didn't really do anything during Gettysburg. He sort of was there, but what did he do? That's a harder thing to determine. So reorganizing the army sooner might have worked in Lee's favor. For the Union Army, although he gets bad marks, Hooker did a good job of doing it. He did a lot of reorganizing. Uh, McClellan basically was still the army was still on the McClellan model when Hooker took over, and so there were a lot of silly things, like there was no cavalry corps, so he formed the cavalry corps. Now, it took a while for the cavalry to get used to operating together, but it did very well at Brandy Station, which was a sign that it may have a shot at greater things. Before that, there were a couple of cavalry regiments assigned to individual divisions, and some generals had like half a regiment of cavalry as their bodyguard. That's a kind of useful thing for the cavalry to be doing, guarding the generals. He also instituted a number of other reforms, a more rational leave policy, and more attention to intelligence. He reorganized the intelligence service of the army. So Meade inherits this.
And did he not also reorganize the artillery?
Yeah. Yeah, the artillery was the orphan of all the armies. We go to the reenactments and whatnot, and you see the artillery and everybody's oohing and aahing, and miss the fact that in both armies, the artillerymen got the short end of the stick. To some extent, this was helped when Hooker reorganized the artillery so that you allocated more artillery to the corps. And one of the advantages of this was you pushed the artillery down a bit so that corps commanders could deploy artillery. But you also they came up with the term brigade, even though you look at it, it looks like a battalion. You know, it's like three batteries of artillery, and it's called a brigade. And that was because the chief of artillery, whose name is slipping my mind at the moment, was trying to convince the War Department to respect the artillery more. A battery of artillery was the equivalent of a regiment of cavalry in terms of cost and firepower and so on. And it was only commanded by a captain. And in many cases, it was a lieutenant or even a second lieutenant who was in command, because so many artillery guys had gotten commissions in the volunteer regiments, regular army artillery guys had gotten commissions in the volunteer regiments because you could get a higher rank. So that was a big help. Just organizing a central artillery reserve, tremendously important. You're giving for the first time the general a large pool of guns that he can play with, and this is why you get that grand battery. It's army level guns supplemented by the corps level guns, which is a big help.
Right.
They're all under one commander. You're beginning to get better coordination with the infantry, although you never get really good coordination. Artillery is always short of manpower, which is, unfortunate. Terribly short of rank. In the Confederate Army, I think only three guys became generals, three artillerymen became generals. I think it was a little better in the Union Army, but not much. So they didn't get much respect. But they were extraordinarily important in the longer range operations. And of course, they were critically important in defensive fire. Lee's preparatory bombardment was by no means as, we spoke about how the shot went mostly over, which was not good for softening up. But you couldn't do much better. So with the thing that the Union artillery does is they stop firing back. For a while they're doing counter battery and they stop firing back. They economize on shells. In fact, at one point, one of the hottest moments of the battle, the chief of artillery is observing a battery, and the guy's firing like mad, and the general's name slips my mind, and I'm really sorry about that. He says, "Young man, do you realize that every one of those shells cost the government $3.75 or something like that?" They're firing up a storm, which is really good in terms of killing the attacking troops, even though it does cost $3.75. The fact that the cavalry is in a corps, immensely important. Meade got the job partly because of, you might almost say it, Hooker had turned everybody off. I mean, he basically demanded of Lincoln that he fire half the army, half the generals. And Lincoln fired him instead.
In fact, Lincoln was going to stick with him until that demand came through,
yes,
right?
Yes. Because he thought everything was fine. He didn't realize how toxic command relations in the army were. That's a 20th century phrase, actually, isn't it? toxic command relationships. The generals basically had already alerted the War Department that there was trouble, and Lincoln offered command. He actually offered to Reynolds, and Reynolds turned it down, which was very interesting. Unfortunately, Reynolds doesn't survive the battle, so we don't know Reynolds' motives. But Reynolds may have the way Hooker had organized the army. Was he broke it into two wings. And Reynolds commanded one wing. Henry Slocum from New York commanded the other. So that there would be no, one hoped there would be no arguments if part of the army was engaged in action. The generals wouldn't have a pissing contest over who outranked who. Reynolds is commanding the right wing, or was the left wing, I forget now. And of course, as soon as Reynolds is wounded, you do get that. You get a pissing contest between the corps commanders that are present. Fortunately, they work it out. So Reynolds turns it down, and I'm trying to remember now, but Reynolds recommends me.
Right.
Yeah. Now, Meade had done, let's put it this way, he had never done spectacularly well, but he had always done well. And he had certainly never done spectacularly badly. And even in the most trying circumstances, his troops had done well. So that he was seen as a good tradesman. Thoughtful commander. It's interesting. Lee's assessment was interesting. Lee's assessment before the battle. When he hears of Meade's appointment, he says, "Meade won't make any mistakes on my front, and if I make any, he'll take advantage of them. He'll take quick advantage of them." Now, they had known each other in the old army, so that may have had some influence there. But it's a very insightful comment, I think. Later on, after the war, Lee will say something like, "Meade was the best opponent he ever faced." Now, that, I think, is Lee trying hard to pretend that the Tanner's son from Illinois hadn't kicked his butt. I mean, you know, I'm talking about Grant, of course.
Right.
Because one of the problems in the post-war writing of history, remember, the winners don't necessarily write the history. We hear that all the time. And yes, it's true that sometimes the winners do write and distort the history. But the losers have a much greater interest in trying to write the history. And if we look at events, I mean, look at how the German army rewrote the history of the First World War, you know, in the interwar period, to prove that they had been cheated out of their victory. And Napoleon, I mean, you know, everybody, this is the greatest general that ever lived. Well, you know, he got his butt kicked. Why did he get his butt kicked? Well, in the post-Civil War era, there was an almost concerted effort by a concerted effort. There are actually letters exchanged between some of these guys, like Jubal Early and Pendleton, Lee's incompetent artillery commander, explaining how they're going to discredit certain people, you know, like Meade and like Longstreet, because Longstreet had said rude things about Lee, the hero of the war. So one of the things is, for example, the portrayal of Grant as the butcher. 700 casualties in 15 minutes at Cold Harbor. 7,000 casualties, rather. Well, there were 7,000 casualties in Grant's command that day. Yes, but they weren't all at Cold Harbor. There was fighting along a huge front. And, you know, the number of dead was not even as bad as Pickett's charge. Obviously for the dead guys it's bad. But this was a deliberate attempt because how could this noble son of the South, this heroic, godlike figure, almost Christ, you know, figure, lose to this tradesman's son who had been a failure in everything he ever did? You know, it can't be. There must be other factors at work here, you know. Treachery by Longstreet is a good one. Butcher, you know, Grant just kept throwing troops at the Confederacy until everybody was dead, and the Confederates had no more troops to put the bitch to fight. Well, actually, if you look at the casualties in battles, Lee always suffered a greater percentage of casualties than his foes. Now, partly that's because he generally had a smaller army, and was generally doing the attacking, which is not a good formula for how shall I say? It's not a good formula for keeping your casualties down. The guy doing the attacking is almost always going to suffer more heavily. So there was this sort of concerted plan to rewrite the history of the war, and part of it affects Gettysburg. Lee's alleged plan for a dawn attack on the second day. This is the attack, of course, which results in the terrible fighting around the wheat field and Devil's Den and whatnot, and the fighting on Little Round Top. And so the myth is that Lee planned an attack at dawn. And Longstreet dawdled in getting his troops into the line, so the attack didn't come until the afternoon. Well, if you look at the arrival times of the troops, there was no way Longstreet could have attacked at dawn, because the last of his troops, after marching all night, didn't arrive until, you know, the late morning, and they needed an hour or so sleep before they were getting ready for the attack. And by the way, Lee hadn't even reconnoitered, hadn't ordered a reconnaissance before dawn, so there was no dawn attack. Yet it entered the history of the battle, because in effect, they're saying, if it wasn't for Longstreet, there would have been this great Confederate victory on the second day, and there would have been no need for the third day. And then Longstreet makes the terrible mistake of criticizing Lee's decisions during the battle, which, of course, puts him totally, totally beyond the pale. Oh, yeah, he also becomes a Republican, which, you know, and actually leads black troops in an attempt to suppress a riot in New Orleans after the war, which is also, of course, a serious no-no. So the battle, you know, assumes certain, a deep political effect too.
Right. Now, Jim, to just wrap this all up, after Gettysburg, I think we really need to take Gettysburg and Vicksburg together, because now we go back to our favorite topic, which is not the historian's favorite topic, but the aftermath of Vicksburg and Gettysburg is that now the South has a tremendous logistical problem, right?
Yes, and the Southern politicians are in a snit. They are very unhappy with this month of disasters. The North was elated. I mean, the media, you can actually see a lot of it is posted on the internet, contemporary newspaper accounts. It's absolutely euphoric because there's been so much bad news, in the year before. Suddenly we have one victory after another. Things are finally turning around. The crowning glory of that string of victories was Gettysburg, because Lee was considered unbeatable. So after all these Western wahoos, defeated, whatever scrubs the rebels had out there, again, it's the total, misunderstanding of what was going on, in the West by the Eastern media. Now you have this, in the East, you have this great victory. And this basically didn't attract people to pay any attention to Southern logistics. But it basically, made Lincoln secure for next year's, election campaign. Because one of the main reasons why Lee was sent north was basically to demoralize the North and get anybody but Lincoln elected president so they could basically have a negotiated peace and, in effect, a Confederate victory.
Right. Well, they hope, did they not also hope that if Lee had won in Pennsylvania, the hope was that the British would come in at that point? And
most Confederate politicians, the smarter ones anyway, didn't really believe there was much hope of the British coming in. That was basically a media invention, which, of course, was very popular in the South for obvious reasons. What the South really needed was the North to decide to basically stop fighting. Because, people who could do the math understood that the South was under a tremendous disadvantage. And again, amateur study tactics, professional study logistics, the business people in the South, people who really understood the economics of the South, realized that they had just suffered a fatal blow, at Vicksburg. And, of course, the ancillary victories didn't help either because, the South didn't have as many railroads. The South had a lot of transportation and economic problems, far more than the North. Actually, the Northern economy was booming because of the war. It was basically a shot in the arm, whereas the South had no way to really take advantage of that because they were not an industrialized economy.
Plus, they had a railroad problem too, mm-hmm. and that their rail lines ran in the wrong direction.
Exactly,
right?
And of course, the North was basically chopping some of the most critical ones, in 1863. And so the news, the Gettysburg was simply the final straw as far as many Southern politicians were concerned, and they were livid that that something had to be done. From that point on, it's like late 1942 for the Germans in World War II, or the Axis in general. Just too many defeats in one small period, and it never got better after that. It was basically the sign that, victory is coming, not tomorrow, there'd be more hard fighting, and indeed there was another 18 months of a pretty, you know, savage campaigning and bloodletting. But it was the beginning of the end, and everybody realized it, although not everybody admitted it.
Right. Yeah, we've gone long, and yeah, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. So we will thank you for the great commentary, guys, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Have a glorious 4th.
We will.